Okay, everybody, good afternoon and welcome to today's webinar. This is a virtual advising session for the Multi-Country Awards in the Fulbright Scholar Program. My name is Michelle Valorci and I'm joined with my colleague here, Caitlin Taylor, and she and I will be going through this session today providing a lot of answers and information to you about the awards in the catalog that offer multi-country options. So before we begin, if you are a student who recently graduated and are interested in doing a study and research program abroad, or if you're not a U.S. citizen, this webinar today would not be for you. We do have information on the Fulbright student program on the website, as well as if you search for opportunities for the Fulbright visiting scholar or foreign student scholar programs as well. Today, the webinar is strictly for U.S.-based scholars and professionals who hold U.S. citizenship and are looking to teach and research abroad. And with that, I'll turn it over to Kate.
Thanks, Michelle. So here's what we're going to do today. First, we're going to briefly go over the multi-country awards to make sure everyone is in the right webinar. If you want more in-depth information about the multi-country awards, you can either head over to the catalog or watch our previous multi-country webinar where we do a really deep dive into the opportunities in terms of, you know, eligibility and the kinds of projects they're looking for. So that's not something that we're going to be going over in depth today. But what we will be doing is offering some application tips and resources, which we tried to tailor to the questions that we received from you over the last couple of days. And then we are going to open it up to your questions after that. So we're hoping to spend the majority of our time on this portion of the presentation, and we will try to get all of your questions answered today.
Great. So before we begin, we'd like to provide a list of all of the multi-country award options available in the catalog. So as you can see, they're outlined here. So the questions that you've asked pertain to these awards, and if you're interested in applying to these awards, this is the session for you. So as you can see, we have an array of opportunities globally, from regional research programs in Africa and South Asia to joint teaching and research awards in Greece and Spain and Morocco and Spain, as well as the Global Scholar Award. So this is the one where you can choose between 2 to 3 world regions and select, you know, for a proposal that involves, kind of has a global aspect to it. And so these are the awards that we're advising on today. And with that, we can go to the next slide.
Okay, so based on some of the questions we've received, there seems to be some confusion about FLEX. So I'm going to go over that in a little more detail. So FLEX is not an award. FLEX is a grant-length feature that is available in some awards. And so is anyone having trouble seeing the slides? I'm seeing one person commenting on that. If you can't see the slides, can you please? Okay, it looks like most of you can see the slides. Okay, I just wanted to double check. Okay, so for the multi-country awards, there are only 3 awards that offer this FLEX option, and that would be the Global Scholar Award, the Middle East and North Africa Regional Research Program, and the Africa Regional Research Program. And so FLEX, the way that it works is it allows you to split up your grant into shorter segments, anywhere between 1 and 3 months long, over 1 or 2 consecutive years. So it sounds confusing, but it's really not. So what you would do is you would have either 2 or 3 separate segments. Instead of 1 long grant, you'd be splitting it up into 2 or 3 different segments. The minimum length for any one of those segments would be 1 month, and the maximum length of any one segment would be 3 months, and then when you add all of the segments up, they would need to be at least 3 months long, but maximum 6 months long. I hope that helps clear things up a little bit. If you are planning on doing Flex, it's really important that you include a very detailed and clear project timeline in your project statement, saying, you know, for month 1 and 2, I'm going to be in this country, and months 2 and 3, I'm going to be in this country, and months 3 and 4, we want to see as much detail as possible. If you can give specific dates or even specific things that you plan on doing at different times during your grant, that's really helpful for us. One question that we got related to Flex was, can the Flex award be used for several countries only in the Western Hemisphere, or must it include different regions? So my understanding is that there is only one multi-country award exclusively in the Western Hemisphere, and that would be the Carlos Rico Award, which would take you to Mexico and Canada. And for that award, Flex is not available. So if you want to do a Flex grant in the Western Hemisphere and you're not doing the Carlos Rico Award, then you would need to include different regions. You would be looking at applying for the Global Award. And that would need to include at least one country from another different world region, which would either be Europe, Middle East, Africa, East Asia, or Southeast Asia. So North America, the Caribbean, Central America, and South America are all included in the Western Hemisphere region as defined by the State Department. I hope that helps that person figure it out, but if you want to do a Flex grant where you would go to the Western Hemisphere, the only award that would offer that, if it's you're looking at a multi-country grant, would be the Global Award.
Okay, great. So now on to the components in the application. So what exactly does that look like? Well, the application is online and it's pretty straightforward. We do have page limits to everything that's listed here, so those limits really do need to be adhered to. If you go over the page limit or do not meet the minimum page requirements for these documents, then you will be contacted by us and we'll ask you to provide the appropriate page limits. So please refer to the guidelines and the directions for the application and all of the different kind of information that we have on our website featuring guidelines on the letter of invitation, the references, the curriculum vitae, et cetera. So in addition to the standard form that you'll be filling out, we ask that you provide a 3 to 5 page project statement. And so broadly speaking, this project statement should address what you propose to do, how you propose to do it, why it's important, and what benefits it will produce for your host institution, for you, and your home institution. So really speaking to the outcomes and the impact. And you'll also need to submit tailored CV of up to 6 pages. Your CV should include only what is most relevant. So we understand it's a challenge to kind of pare it down, but really do think of just the things that you need to list that relates to the project and what the committee should know about your profile. You can eliminate information, you know, the identifying information such as your phone number and email. All of that we'll have in the form. It's important to include all of your education and your employment history. But limit previous awards and grants and fellowships to what is relevant for the review committee to know. And try to include as many publications, relevant publications, as you can, but you can keep conference presentations and exhibits to a minimum. We do ask that academic service and professional affiliations can be cut down, and you can also explain your language capabilities elsewhere in the application form. So any of that that would take up space on your CV, you can pare down. So in terms of the letters of reference, we do require 3. And if you're proposing to teach, one of the reference letters should address your teaching style and your someone who can speak to that. We have requirements for submission about the references on our website, so there's some guidelines there. But I really want to underscore that applicants should register all 3 of their references in the online application, and then the link will be sent to your referees, so let them know in advance that you're contacting them for that, and they can also check their junk mail or their spam folder in case it doesn't go into their inbox. So just to underscore the fact that we cannot receive emailed letters of reference, It does have to go through our system. They have to be uploaded into our system, and so emailed or snail mail references are not accepted. Also, if you're proposing to teach, you will need to submit 2 to 3 sample course descriptions or syllabi, and with a total page limit of 10 pages. So all 2 or 3 syllabi can be no more than 10 pages total. And they should be designed by you and expressive of your teaching philosophy. It would also help if you could indicate whether you've used these syllabi in the past or if you've tailored them for the particular project that you're proposing. And if you're conducting research, we ask that you submit a 3-page bibliography, which is more like a literature review, without the extensive annotations. We're not requiring that you list your publications. We'll see that in your CV, but the bibliography of really what are the state of the art of what you're proposing. Depending on the award, there are some language proficiency requirements that will be outlined in the award description. So whether you need to provide a self-evaluation or the external evaluation of your language proficiency, so be sure that you check for that. Oftentimes, research projects require a level of local language fluency. So otherwise, you have to demonstrate that you're able to conduct that feasibly without the language. And non-native speakers who have foreign language abilities will be asked to complete a 2-part language proficiency report. Part 1 is the self-evaluation, as I mentioned earlier, and part 2 is the external evaluation. This should be completed by someone at an appropriate foreign, who's an appropriate foreign language instructor. If you're based at a university, you can reach out to your Fulbright Scholar Liaison for a contact in the respective language department. And then last but not least, if you come from any of the fields such as arts, architecture, writing, and journalism, we ask that you submit supplemental materials and kind of like a online, mini portfolio. There's more information on our website about that, we're happy to help you if you email us and you're not sure about what would constitute supplemental materials. And keep in mind for the supplemental materials, we also do have file size limits. And page limits. So if you're a journalist and submitting some writing samples, there are page limits, and then video clips and music clips, et cetera, have file size limits.
Awesome. Thanks, Michelle. So before I move on to the letter of invitation, there's a good question I just saw about Flex. If the program in which I am interested does not have Flex as a feature, can I request it? Can it be added? The answer to that is no. If it doesn't offer Flex, then that means this year it is, that's not going to change. You can always check back next year. Our catalog is dynamic and changes every year slightly, so there's always a chance that next year the award might offer Flex, but if it isn't offering it this year, then, that's not going to be an option. Okay, so on to the letter of invitation. Depending on the award that you apply to, a letter of invitation may be required. So for the multi-country award opportunities, the letter is either going to be required or preferred. So you should really be getting one if it may be required. And if it says preferred, it means that, if you don't have one, you're going to be at a pretty significant disadvantage in the review process because others may have them. And if you don't, the chances of you being selected for a grant would be slim. So the letter of invitation is an expression of interest from a host institution, and the letter would need to include, what you're being invited to do, the period of time you're invited for it, so it should include dates if possible, and then good letters, this isn't required, but really good letters will have a description of the host's interest in your project. The letter would need to be on official letterhead. And if the letter isn't in English, you'll need to include an English translation of it along with the original. We received some questions prior to the webinar about how to choose a host institution or whether there is a list of partner institutions in different fields. So if you do not have contacts in your country of interest or the contact information is not already listed in the award description, which it often is, we have some recommendations. First and foremost, use the resources on your home campus, such as your international office or even, talking to your colleagues. They may have connections that they could put you in touch with. You can also take a look at our scholar directory, which lists the names, project titles, countries, and host institutions of previous Fulbrighters. So you can go in and look and see where people have gone before. And if you see that there's a person that has done a project similar to what you're planning to do, you know, you can reach out to them and say, hey, you know, I'm interested in doing a Fulbright at the same institution you went to. Would you be able to put me in touch with your contacts? And 9 times out of 10, the alumni will, our alumni will, you know, be helpful, and they'll be able to do that for you. So the scholar directory is a good place to start. Even if you don't want to reach out to the alumni, it may give you a sense of the different institutions that have hosted Fulbrighters before, and then you can, you know, you can do your own research from there. Also, you know, Google is your best friend. Look at university websites in your host country, and oftentimes you can locate contact information for different departments, you know, straight from the website. You can find this information with just a couple of keystrokes. So we personally at IIE, we do not keep the names or contact information of people at specific host institutions. We don't have any lists to provide you. So this part of the application is going to require some hard work and ingenuity on your part. So the best place to get a sense of where Fulbrighters have gone before is the Scholar Directory, like I noted. We received a question about whether any Fulbrighters have pursued opportunities in Greece. Yes, check the Scholar Directory and you'll be able to see a list of people that have gone there before. There are also a couple of questions about what kinds of institutions could serve as a host. This is going to depend on the award, so check the award description first and foremost. But in general, you know, universities are where most applicants affiliate. But depending on your field, that may not be the best fit. We've also seen artist residencies, museums, archives, in some cases, government agencies, nonprofits, theaters, arts organizations, and many more. So if you have any questions about whether your host would be appropriate, you know, please reach out. Our sort of rule of thumb, though, is that for-profit organizations are not eligible as hosts. And then any American branch campuses or American organizations that happen to operate in the country wouldn't be eligible either. They would need to be local organizations. Another good question I saw was, can a referee also be the person writing the letter of invitation for the host institution? No. So the person that writes your letter of invitation cannot also write a letter of reference. Those would need to be separate.
Okay, great. So now moving on to how to submit a competitive application. And oftentimes, I get questioned, you know, which award is not as competitive, or, you know, which one has fewer applicants, et cetera. And I just want to let you know that in general, the Fulbright program, the Fulbright Scholar Program, is a competitive process, and we are looking to see the Fulbright quality, you know, looking for the Fulbright standard in your application. And so how you can do that, we've got some bullet points here for you to consider. The first thing is to address why you're applying for a Fulbright. So, you know, speaking to promoting mutual understanding, intercultural collaboration, people to people, kind of serving as an ambassador, not only of the U.S., but of your institution as well. So kind of discussing why Fulbright. And then really focusing on the impact and what you hope to do, why that particular country, why that particular host institution, et cetera. And in order for your application to be really competitive, it needs to be clear, concise, and compelling. So it needs to really capture the imagination of the peer review committee as well as the in-country commission or the embassy that's reviewing these. So each individual application should really reflect your profile, what you hope to do, how you're a good fit for it, and what outcomes can be expected. So in terms of specifically if we discuss the project statement, this is your opportunity to shine. So you have 3 to 5 pages to really convey a clear, concise, and compelling project. You should start out with a brief introduction of who you are so that the review committee knows that you are a good, that what your profile is and what you propose to do is a suitable match. And then go on and talk about your professional experiences and your skills and what you have to offer the host country, the host institution. and also what you hope to gain from the experience, how this will, you know, develop you professionally and add to what your, you know, trajectory is. What are the potential long-term impacts? What are the impacts in country when you come back? And also, keeping in mind, you know, you're going to a different place. Things may not go according to plan. So speaking to your adaptability and your flexibility, things like that, how you would deal with challenging situations. You might have a syllabus developed for a particular course, and when you get there, you realize the students are at a different level. So, you know, realizing that you'd have to make some last-minute adjustments and kind of start fresh, things like that. So kind of being adaptable and speaking to that. And really focusing on what you plan to do, not just reciting your resume, but really, you know, giving us a timeline, you know, what you hope to do in this month and at this and at the end, all of that. So being, you know, having that level of specificity will really help. And we do often get questions, how can I make my application strong and how can I make it competitive? And, you know, really just talking about the impacts, I can't underscore that enough. Demonstrating your commitment to Fulbright's mission, again, the cultural diplomacy, serving as an ambassador of the U.S., cultural ambassador, and having really an organized project statement. I know we talk to the, you know, we tell our students, we discuss this with our colleagues all the time, really speaking about what we want to do in a clear and organized fashion. This is no exception. We really want to see how you can do all this and still leave room for flexibility and adaptability when you go on a grant.
Okay, there are a couple more questions about the letter of invitation, so I want to just rewind for a minute. So there are a lot of questions about who the letter should be from. Does it need to be from a dean or a faculty member? Should it come from someone high up? So it can come from either. We will accept letters from either. We generally advise that the letter should come from whoever you plan to collaborate most closely with, because that person is going to be able to speak more to your project. There will be more of that personal touch in the letter. Whereas sometimes if a dean, you know, that is not really familiar with you or your research writes a letter, you know, it may be, you know, a sort of pro forma letter. So, you know, it can, and a lot of times some universities, if professors are not comfortable writing the letter of invitation, they, you know, they want it to come from someone higher up, you know, and sometimes that just happens to be the policy at whatever institution you're planning to go to. So use your best judgment, but we will accept letters from either. And then there was a question about host institutions. So I talked about that. You know, institutions need to be locally based. Would UN-affiliated organizations also not be allowed? So that's a good question, and it's sort of a case-by-case basis thing. So if you're, you know, for example, we have seen, I did see an applicant affiliate with the Catholic Relief Services, and that was approved, but again, that is a case-by-case basis thing. So if you do have sort of a UN or international organization that you want to work with, just send an email to whoever. I'm assuming this is probably for the Global Award, but send an email to the Global Award inbox, and I'll follow up on that with the State Department to make sure that it would be an approved institution. We don't see a lot of applications using international institutions, so we don't, you know, we don't have a sort of blanket yes or no. We like to do those, you know, case by case. Okay,
so we wanted to show you the timeline of the review process, just to let you know that it does take some time. So we are, the awards that we're discussing today are for the 2019-2020 academic year. And so the deadline this year is August 1st. For those awards. After we receive all the applications on August 1st, we conduct a technical review. So we're reviewing for eligibility and then in September, we convene the discipline-specific committees that will review your application, and they're from your discipline, they're testing for academic merit, et cetera, looking to see the quality of the application and the project proposed. After that, from early from September to early November, we convene peer review committees. They're kind of regional review committees in Washington, D.C. And these are typically former grantees, so Fulbright alumni, who have gone to the country or region that you're applying to. And they're from a range of disciplines. And they sit together and review all of the applications and really kind of go through. And they either recommend or they don't recommend applications for the final review in country. So either at the Fulbright Commission abroad, or if there isn't a commission in that country, the post, the American Embassy, does the final review and selection. And then from November to January, applicants are given an update on their status, and the recommended applicants are also processed through they go through the process of being vetted by the Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board, the FFSB. And notifications come out as early as February and as late as May. So from February to May, you can expect to receive a final notification whether you were selected or not. And then after that, we send packets to grantees, and then there's pre-departure orientations for some countries, and then otherwise, after that, you're on your merry way, and you'll have your, most likely you'll have an orientation in-country at the commission.
Awesome. And one thing I want to sort of note about the timeline that we get all the time is just that the notification timeline, you're hearing back too late, and it can cause some issues with your department if you're not telling your department chair until spring that you're not going to be teaching in the fall. So what I always recommend to applicants is if you make it through the first round of peer review, you'll get your first notification, usually right around either before or after Thanksgiving. If you find out that your application was forwarded onto the host country for further review, that's a good time to start a conversation with your department chair about the fact that you've applied for a Fulbright and maybe start to plan a contingency, if you are not going to be teaching. That'll give them more time to find someone to teach your classes, which then means that there's more of a chance that they will say yes and accept your proposal to be gone for, the fall or the spring or however long you're going to be gone for. So letting them know as early as possible will help to avoid some of those conflicts. Okay, so a lot of you, I believe, are applying for the Global Award, so I wanted to spend a couple of minutes addressing some of the questions that have come up about Global specifically. But first, I wanted to announce a very important update. So in previous years, applicants were able to start their grants as early as May of the following spring, but in the last 2 weeks, the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs made a change regarding start dates. So for Global, the earliest that you could start your grant would be June 15th of 2019. So we've also received a lot of questions about professional projects. We're still working on an official definition of professional projects. So we're kind of testing it out this year. But the working definition right now is that, a professional project is an activity type that provides opportunities for U.S. professionals and artists in various fields to interact with relevant organizations abroad to further their professional goals. And so professional projects might include things like visits to organizations in the applicant's professional field, practical experience in actual operations, public lectures, or other appropriate professional activities. The project should be of the applicant's design. So if you wanted to use the professional project to go and do an established training or workshop that's already offered overseas, that wouldn't be eligible. And you would want to include a concrete description of your planned activities during the grant period in your project statement. What we want to see in the application if you're applying for a professional project is to sort of explain the expected benefits for completing the project, for furthering your career. The category is really intended for applicants outside of what we consider traditional academia. A couple of examples from past years, include there was a police officer that applied for the program that worked with military hostage rescue units overseas That was a professional project, not traditional research or teaching. We also had an artist that attended several artist residencies. We saw a lawyer that did a professional project. He offered sort of a train-the-trainer workshop to help law professors start up legal clinics at their institutions. So if you have any questions about whether your project would fall under this new activity, contact me at the globalaward@iie.org address. We're still kind of working on, and all the questions that we get are helping us to sort of narrow down our definition of professional project. And then in terms of application materials, the professional projects should include the same materials as research projects. So you would need to include a bibliography, and that would sort of demonstrate to the peer review committees that you have a context of key work related to your proposal. So you would be including critical theory related to your project, which might include, you know, it might include journal articles, like a traditional sort of scholarly bibliography. But you can also include, you know, works or exhibitions by other artists, reports, films, court cases, digital images. There are all kinds of different things that you could include, just to give the reviewers a sense of where your project fits within the broader context of what's going on in your field. We've had a lot of questions about, you know, like, would this host be appropriate? Would this be appropriate? So listed on the screen are some possibilities. If you're interested in a K-12 organization or a private business, you know, please reach out. Like I said, private businesses are not eligible, and the K-12 is something that it really depends on the country that you're going to. So if you're interested in a K-12, reach out, and I will have to reach out to the U.S. Embassy in those countries to make sure that it's eligible. It oftentimes has to do with the ministries in most countries. The Ministry of Higher Education is usually different from the Ministry of K-12 education. So the visa process might be different. But anyway, that's all to say, if that's what you're interested in, reach out to me and I will check for you. And then I've also received a lot of inquiries along the lines of, you know, the award to Nigeria doesn't allow research. Can I still do research? So the answer is that you should not be looking to other awards, other award descriptions for anything other than getting a sense of the award benefits stipend. The award parameters are in the global award description, and that is the only set of requirements you should be looking at. So if Nigeria says, you know, they only allow teaching, that doesn't mean that you, if you apply for global award, if you want to go to Nigeria, you can only teach. That requirement, the activity type requirement, doesn't apply to the global award. And then I've received countless questions about whether I can go to this country or that country. The catalog is going to be your best friend for answering this question yourself, which I'm going to get to in the next slide and show you how to do it. But the short answer is that countries must be in at least two different world regions. So you could not go to two countries in Europe or two countries in the Western Hemisphere. You would need to have a selection of different world regions represented in your project. And then host countries must have an active Fulbright program. So every year we get questions about Switzerland, Lebanon, Chad, Martinique. The simple answer is that if it is not listed as a country in the awards catalog, it is not eligible because we don't send Fulbrighters there. And then last note on global, I want to underscore that you need to have one letter of invitation per country that you're going to, no more, no less. You can't have two letters from one country. It needs to just be one letter per country. Okay. I'm seeing more questions about global. So in the global program, can I teach in one country but not in the other? Yes, but you need to explain why in your project statement. With global projects, all of the segments should be interrelated. So you wouldn't want to go to Brazil to teach a scientific methods workshop and then go to Japan to do completely different research in a lab, unless you can make a strong case for exactly how the two segments are related to each other. What is the longest I can stay in one country? So check out the award description, but the maximum length for any segment is 3 months, and the minimum is 1 month. When you add all of the segments up, they need to be anywhere between 3 and 6 months long. Is the global award significantly more competitive than single country awards? So I can't go into application numbers, but I feel pretty comfortable saying that yes, the Global Scholar Award is by far the most competitive in the catalog. So you need to make a very strong case for why multiple countries are necessary for your project. Why can this work only be done in these 2 or 3 countries and nowhere else? If you're just applying for global because you think it would be fun to go to the UK and South Africa instead of just one or the other, your application is not going to be as competitive as someone who, you know, might, for example, be following the migration of a certain type of bird from country to country. I don't know much about, like, if they wanted to go to Canada, Russia, and Spain to follow a particular, you know, animal or something like that. But that's just an example of the kind of project that would be appropriate for global. You need to make a strong case for why multiple countries and not just multiple countries for the heck of it. Are you able to do 2 countries if 3 countries are not approved? No. So host countries are able to weigh in on global projects, and if they say no, then the project will not be funded in full. Host countries don't play a huge role in the selection process for global. The way that it works is we solicit feedback from them. They fill out a short survey online. But ultimately, the State Department is the one making the decisions about which projects receive funding. So make sure that you're keeping them in mind as a very important stakeholder, and making that argument for why your project accomplishes Fulbright's mission of promoting mutual understanding and how it fits in, you know, perhaps with the State Department's priorities or the U.S. national interest. Can I pick any 2 countries such as China and the UK? As long as there are 2 different world regions and they're listed in the catalog, then yes. Okay. A question, can I apply for more than 1 award? Can I apply for global and a single country award? No, you can only apply to 1 award. Do you need to have completed a terminal degree in your field to apply for a global scholar? No, a terminal degree is not required for the global award. Can young professionals qualify for this award? Yes, young professionals can apply for the Global Scholar Award. I would say that to be competitive for this award, you would need to have a good amount of experience. So if you're only 1 or 2 years into your career, I would maybe recommend taking a look at the student program, the Fulbright U.S. student program, because the global award, because it is just so competitive, we really do want to see applications from people that do have experience. Okay. Can someone apply for a global scholar and a specialist award at the same time? Yes, you can be on the specialist roster and receive a scholar grant at the same time. You just couldn't complete both grants at the same time. So if you get a scholar grant and you go out to the country that you're going to, you're planning to go to, and then you hear from the specialist program and they say, hey, you're on the roster, we have a project for you, can you do it? You wouldn't be able to. You can't go on a specialist grant while you're a U.S. scholar and vice versa. Okay, so at this point in the presentation, I did want to give you guys sort of an example of what the grant could look like, with Flex. This would be specifically for global. So there are 3 different ways that you can do a global award, that you can arrange it in terms of grant segments. Scenario 1 is one multi-country trip. This would be going out on one long grant where you would go, from one country straight to the next country and then straight to the 3rd country with no breaks in between. So that is scenario 1. And then scenarios 2 and 3 are what we consider flex. So scenario 2, you could do 2 or 3 single country trips. So you could go to, France for 2 months and then come back to the U.S. and then go back out in the spring to Morocco, and then come home, and then the following fall go out to Brazil and then come home. So that, because you're breaking them up into shorter segments that you're spreading out over a whole year, that is considered flex. And you can do up to three of these single country trips. And then you can't do more than that. You can't do 4 or 5 single country trips. The maximum number is 3. And then scenario 3, you could do 2 dual country trips. Or if you wanted to go to France and Morocco, you know, one fall and then the following fall, go back and do, you know, another dual country trip, that's fine. We don't allow for multiple triple country trips. So if you were wanting to do scenario 1 twice, that's not eligible. You can only do dual country trips, multiple dual country trips, not multiple triple country trips. I hope these examples help to kind of illustrate that a little bit. But at this point in the presentation, we want to take you to the catalog, where I'm going to be able to show you the answers to a lot of your questions. So this is the catalog. I'm sure all of you have been in there. But if you want to take a look at the multi-country awards, here they are. I'm going to click on the Global Scholar Award, just because that's kind of the topic we're on right now. And this is where you're able to find a lot of the information that you're looking for, particularly with regard to the grant length, the grant start dates. The new early start date is reflected in the awards catalog. You'll be able to find a lot of information here. If you go over to the award requirements tab, I saw a couple of questions about language requirements. This is where you'll be able to find information about language requirements under this award requirements tab. Also, whether a letter of invitation is required would be found here. And then you'll also be able to find information about whether professionals outside of academia are eligible, then yes, for global they are. So that's one way to kind of use the catalog. Another thing, I was talking earlier about how will we know if a country is eligible. That's fairly simple. If you're on the main page of the award, of the catalog of awards, and you just select this country area little box, this is the list of countries that are eligible. If the country you want to go to is not listed here, then it is not a place you could go on the global award. Important. And then another question we get all the time is what are the benefits for this grant? How much is the stipend? And the way that will work is you will go, the different rates depend on the different countries that you're going to. They're sort of set by cost of living in different cities and areas. So if you are, for example, we can kind of stick with the Morocco example that I've been going with. You can go to Morocco and, you know, look at one of the awards to just Morocco. And if you navigate over to the award benefits tab, this will give you a sense of what your stipend would be in Morocco. There's the one for Morocco, and then let's say you want to look and see about Spain. You go look at Spain, take a look at one of their awards. You can do the All Disciplines Award. This will give you a sense of what the stipend would be when you're in Spain. So the rates would be different based on which countries you're in. I just want to note that these are estimates. So you can't, don't hold us to the exact dollar amount, but they're meant to give you an idea of what the grant benefits will be. If you're selected for a grant, you'll receive a grant contract that will show you the exact dollar amount of your grant. So that's, where you can find that. I think that's pretty much all I wanted to do in the catalog. One other thing I did want to show you is if we go into a specific award, we get a lot of questions, can I do teaching here? Can I do research here? The grant activity that's listed on the side here is going to tell you what kinds of activities are permissible. And then I get a lot of questions, is Flex available? It will say explicitly in the award description if Flex is available. Okay, so heading back to the presentation. So listed on the screen are a couple of resources that we frequently direct applicants to. Our website offers a lot of information about your project statements, letters of invitation. All of the information that we've gone over today essentially is all on our website. So you should review these web pages before beginning your application. I also want to quickly announce that we are going to be hosting some application walkthrough and advising sessions in July. So that's July 18th, 25th, and 30th. So these sessions are designed to answer your questions about how to complete the online application. So if you're interested, just reach out and I can send you the link to where you would register for the webinar. And for those that are asking, can we have the slides, a recording of this presentation and the slides are going to be uploaded onto our website, usually within a week or so. So you'll, have access to them soon. Okay, so now we're going to open the floor to your questions. I see many of you already have, but you can go ahead and start typing them into the chat box on your screen. I want to just note that if your question is very specific to your situation, that may be something better taken offline. We want to make sure that we're answering questions that are, that benefit everyone here. We have, 75 of you here today. So if it's really specific to your application, then, reach out to us separately and we can talk about your specific case. Okay. Michelle, do you want to start out with some questions?
Sure. Okay, so we have a question about, and I think we might have addressed it in one of the slides earlier, does offering a teaching component increase the strength of my application? And generally, you should think of what you propose to do in that project and if teaching makes sense. Because not only do you have to consider what's important or relevant to the project and the host country and host institutions, but also the timeline. So if you simply don't have enough time to do your research project as well as teach a course, then that would not be considered a feasible project. So really, in general, there is no preference unless it's stated in the award description. And in the case for the global, I believe teaching and research both are available. And for the other, the multi-country regional award, for example, the South and Central Asia Regional Research Award, that's strictly a research project, research program. So the award will kind of guide you as to what it prefers. But in general, in the Fulbright program, if it's open to all three activities, in other words, teaching, research, or a combination of teaching and research, then that's fair game. So you really need to think, what do you want to do, what's feasible within the time period, and what is the host interested in? So all of those things.
Awesome. Okay, so there's a question. I just saw it. Where did it go? There's a really good question. How can we locate the Fulbright liaison at our university? So you can find that on our website, which I will take you to now. If you go to the website, you go to the on-campus tab and the Fulbright Scholar Liaison. And then... Oh, maybe it's this one. Yeah, okay. So it's the Fulbright, the Scholar Liaison Network is what you click on. And then you just type in the name of your institution, click search, and, your university should be listed here. If it's not, reach out to us. I think we have, liaisons on most campuses, but there may be some that we don't have them. But, you can find it on our website, on-campus Scholar Liaison Network. Boom, it's right there.
Okay, and we had a question, is there an advantage in applying for a multi-country versus a single country award? In other words, are there more awards given for one type over the other? So really you need to think again about what do you hope to do? What's your project focused on? If it really only focuses on one country, and it would be difficult for you to add a justification for going to another country, then stick with the single country award. I wouldn't put too much importance on the number of grants available, because in general the Fulbright program is very competitive, and so you need to be submitting your, you know, the most competitive and compelling application, and one that makes sense, that speaks to the feasibility and suitability of what you hope to do and where you hope to do it. So if it looks like you've just tacked on another country to qualify for a multi-country award, but you really only need to be in one place, the review committee will see that. And so it's really important to go back to what you hope to do and where you hope to do it and apply for the award that best fits your project.
Okay. Do you have to have IRB approval for a study before your application is submitted? No, we don't require that, but it's okay, if you do have it, it's okay to mention it in your project statement. Not required, though. Another one, what are some of the housing options for Fulbright scholars? So unless it's otherwise listed in the award description or, you know, offered by your host institution when you speak with them, then scholars are expected to arrange their own housing. But you do often get help from, you know, the Fulbright commissions or U.S. embassies. But part of your stipend is intended to cover housing costs, and where you stay ultimately is up to you.
Yeah, and we had another question. For multi-country and global scholar awards, must the research project be the same across countries, or can one work on two different projects in two different countries? And the answer is you need to propose a project that requires you to visit those two and three different countries. So we don't want to see a separate project for each country. It should really be one project that requires you to visit two to three countries. So keep that in mind. That's a good question. One project for multiple countries.
Okay. Do letters of reference have to be submitted before August 1st, or will referees be contacted once the application is submitted and they submit letters at that point? So when you'll go into the online application and register your referee. And once they're registered, that's when they will get the email letting them know that they can upload the letters. That can happen, but you don't have to submit your application in order for them to get that notification. They'll get it just as soon as you register them. And then in terms of when they have to be submitted, the official deadline is August 1st. We do have a little bit of a grace period with letters of reference. Of about a week, but you should really aim to get them in by August 1st if you are able to. okay, I'm a writing researcher. Do I need to submit supplemental materials, or is that only for writers, for creative writers and journalists? So yes, it would only be for writers in creative writing or journalism. You would not need to submit supplemental materials for a discourse analysis project. This looks like a global question. Does the host institution have to be an academic institution? Could it be, for example, the National Park Service of that country? Send me an email of the countries that you're planning on going to. I'm inclined to say yes, that the National Park Service would be an eligible host. I'll check with the host country first. But it does not have to be an academic institution. There are lots of other institution types that are eligible. Okay, I see another question here. Are visiting assistant professors non-tenure track eligible? Generally, yes. So award descriptions will say if they're looking for someone more senior. That would mostly only be for the Distinguished Chair Awards. But unless otherwise mentioned, non-tenure track professors are eligible. And just make sure you read the award description to fully see if there are any other requirements, such as years of teaching. But whether or not your tenure track does not matter. You're eligible either way.
We had another question. Can the program suggest hosts or facilitate a connection with a relevant Fulbright scholar when the applicant is a first-time applicant and has not been to that country before? And yes, we can offer assistance, and we would also point you in the direction of the Fulbright Scholar Directory. So you can search for the list through the list of past Fulbright scholars to a particular country in a particular discipline and see where they have been placed. And then you could also reach out to them, see if they might be able to connect you. If there's any if you go on the individual country awards and you see any of the commission's contact, that means they're open to having scholars reach out to them. If they have proposed locations for that particular award, you can reach out to those. They usually provide the links. And we're also happy to track down some institutions that might be suitable for you. So absolutely. And especially for the Global Award and the multi-country awards, they do require letters of invitation. So it is important that you start that process as soon as possible.
Can couples sometimes apply for simultaneous Fulbrights at the same institution where they have different disciplines? So it's not possible to submit a joint application. You and your partner would need to apply separately. And each applicant and project would be evaluated on its own merit. So you shouldn't focus on your partner's project at all in your project statement. You can mention it, but it's possible that one project might be selected but not the other. So in that case, if your project's feasibility depends heavily on the other project's funding, then you could both end up not being selected. So you can refer to your partner's application in your project statement, but I would leave it to just a sentence or two. But can both people apply for an award at the same institution? Absolutely, yes, as long as the applications are separate and don't depend on each other. You just have to have a strong enough marriage to compete against each other, which would essentially be what you would be doing.
Okay, we had another question. Who should we contact to get a letter of invitation for a country? Is there an organization or government office we should be targeting? So again, it really depends on where you envision your project, where you hope to collaborate and do the research. So again, it's not, unless it's specifically outlined in the award where you will be placed, if there's a location mentioned or if it's a partner award with a particular university. But in the case of the global and the multi-country awards, you will need to determine where you would be best placed and affiliated abroad. So really thinking about different universities or research centers, think tanks, et cetera, that would be a good fit. So looking at, the Fulbright Scholar Directory would be another great option, as I mentioned, and also contacting us individually, we can assist you with that.
Okay, what happens if one of the countries is no longer deemed safe by the State Department? So decisions about which countries are eligible are made very carefully by the State Department every year. If for some reason they determine that one of the countries you're proposing to go to is no longer safe before you go out on your grant, then one of two things might happen. Most likely, it would mean that your entire project would not receive funding. So please do choose wisely. In some cases, applicants are asked to choose another country to replace the country that's no longer eligible. If you had three countries that you were planning to go to and one of them, falls through, that, there may be a question of feasibility of conducting your grant in just two of the countries. That is less common, but it can happen in some cases. If you're already on your grant and the Fulbright program is suspended in the country that you're in, then you would be removed from the country. What exactly that looks like depends on the situation. In most cases, it would mean they just put you on a plane home. But all of this is really determined on a case-by-case basis with very close collaboration between the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs and us at IIE and then the U.S. Embassy and Fulbright Commissions in the country. Every situation like that is pretty unique. But this is all to say that we're not going to send you somewhere that isn't safe, and we're not going to let you stay somewhere that isn't safe. It really depends on the situation.
Well, we've hit the 3 o'clock hour. Kate, should we take a couple more questions and then bring the webinar to a close?
Yeah, let's try and do a handful of more questions. I have a couple that were sent in that I want to read out really quickly. One question about the Fulbright grantee directory, when will it be updated? That happens every October. Another one that was good. Oh, is it an advantage to have visited the country prior to being awarded a grant? So in general, we give priority to people that haven't had significant experience in the host country. However, in countries in certain regions, sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and beyond, they do often want to see applicants who are able to who have prior experience in the region and can handle, more challenging environments, or maybe that have language abilities, to be able to complete a grant. So, for the majority of cases, it's about how you frame it. You want to frame it as an advantage, and talk about, what new things you're planning to get out of the grant that you didn't already get when you had spent time there previously, and then. There were a couple of questions about dual citizenship. So, for the majority of countries, dual citizenship isn't an issue. If there is, it will say so in the award description for that country. Just check with the program officer listed in the award description if you're unsure. Another good question was, for teaching or teaching research awards, what is the best way to propose or suggest what courses one should teach? The best way to do that is to talk to your host institution and ask. You can provide them with, maybe a description of a couple of different kinds of courses that you're able to teach. But just ask them what they have a need for. In those cases, that's usually when you have a much stronger letter of invitation, if it's more of a collaborative project between you and the host rather than you just proposing to come there to teach what you want to teach. Want to take a couple more, Michelle?
Sure. So the question is, should the three references be from the U.S., or host country, or a mix of both? So really, we would want to see an array of references, a variety, and if you're doing a teaching and research award, then certainly someone, in the U.S. who can speak to your teaching abilities and your performance, so someone from your home institution preferably. For the research awards, absolutely, they can come from abroad, but we would like to see, of course, at least one from the U.S. If they all were from abroad, it might be considered a bit odd, because we do want to see what your colleagues here in the U.S., have them speak to your teaching and research abilities and your merit and all of that. So having a mix is fine. They can come from the U.S. and abroad.
Is a U.S. embassy in the country an eligible host institution? No, you cannot affiliate with the U.S. embassy. There's a question about alternates, that some applicants are neither accepted or rejected. They're waitlisted. Does that happen? If so, do people really move off that list and are awarded Fulbright? So, yes, we usually do have alternates. Yes, people do move from alternates to selectees. It does happen. There's no guarantee, of course, but circumstances come up. Sometimes people have already accepted a different grant, and then we, would call up alternates. But yes, that is a possibility. Michelle, there's one that I think maybe you could answer. Is the Core Fulbright different from the Fulbright Nehru Scholarship?
Sure. So the Fulbright Nehru Award is a core award. So it's not different from the core. It's just called the Fulbright Nehru Academic and Professional Excellence Award. And we also have, this is the award to India. We also have the Fulbright Nehru Distinguished Chair Award. So again, as Kate mentioned, per competition, you can only apply for one Fulbright Scholar Award. So whether it's the Global Scholar Award, whether it's the Fulbright Nehru, or any of the other multi-country award options we mentioned. If you're not successful this competition, you're welcome to apply again next year. So there's no limit as to how many times you can apply, nor are there limits on how many Fulbright grants you can receive. So if you plan on reapplying within the, you know, once you become eligible again, so we ask that there's a 2-year waiting period from the time you complete a Fulbright grant to the time that you apply for another one. We ask that you, you know, discuss in your project statement why you're reapplying and how you hope to, you know, build upon that, so providing that justification for a second or third Fulbright. But yes, so what we're in terms of the core program, the global and the multi-country awards fit under, they fall under the global, the core category.
Okay, a good global question. When looking in the catalog, countries typically list disciplines and areas of research they prioritize. If our Global Scholar Project falls outside of those listed, should we look elsewhere, even if we have a letter of invitation and a collaborator? So I think I said earlier, don't look to the award descriptions for anything, the other award descriptions for anything other than the award benefits. If they don't list your discipline in that award, it doesn't matter for global. You should still go ahead and pursue what you were planning on doing. And can I submit more than one application overall, not in the same competition? Yeah, you can apply as many times as you want. Like Michelle said, there's the 2-year waiting period. Are there any other ones that we didn't get to? I want to try and get to as many as we can. I know that these questions are important.
Yeah, it seems like we're still getting a lot of questions about the letter of invitation. So please note that we do have all of the, you know, all of the guidance that you would need to know for that. It's on our website when you go under application guidelines. And the letter, keep in mind, should be uploaded by you, so it would be addressed to you. You will have the copy. If they've emailed it to you and scanned it, you would upload the PDF to the application. So the letter of invitation is something that you can certainly, you know, have a role in, you know, requesting. Perhaps if they write a letter of invitation that doesn't seem to be as specific as you had hoped, if you are comfortable in requesting a little more detailed one, that's fine. But you will be uploading that to the application. The letters of reference, on the other hand, are uploaded directly by the referees to our system.
There's just so many good questions. I don't know which one to choose. There was one question I saw, if there was some research, pre-travel legwork that needs to be done in the U.S. before leaving for the host country, does Fulbright fund that research too? No, we would only be funding research that's taking place in the host country. How do we get access to the recording? We'll send that out to you guys when it's available. Is it possible to search for Global Scholar awardees in the Scholar Directory? So they're in there, but they're hard to search by. I would recommend taking a look at the Global page on our website, and we have a list of profiles of people that have gotten global awards. It hasn't been updated for this most recent competition, but it does have the first two years of global there. Uh, Okay, there's more questions about the bibliography for creative writers versus researchers. Okay, so if you have, it depends on if you're teaching, if you're doing any research. If you're doing research, regardless of your discipline, you'll need to include a bibliography. And that will look like a, you know, literature review, like we mentioned earlier. The difference between a fine arts applicant and a researcher would be that a fine arts applicant would be submitting a portfolio, an example of their work. You wouldn't, not everyone is supposed to submit writing samples. I know that many of you are, you know, write as part of your jobs, and are, but we would only be asking for a writing sample if you are, you know, creative writer or a journalist. I hope that clarifies.
And we had a question about, is there a benefit to emphasizing social relevance to projects? That's a great question, and really the best way to think about this is what is really relevant and important and compelling to that particular country. So those kind of projects that speak to the host country's priorities and kind of things that are topical and relevant are definitely going to be compelling and perhaps prioritized by the commission. So that speaks to the suitability of what you're proposing, that it makes sense that you're proposing a project that really speaks directly to the needs and the issues of that particular country. You know, not that your project statement is so generic that if you replace the country title, the country name, you know, it would be something that could be, you know, fit anywhere and really not be specific. So having something that's relevant to the country, absolutely, that adds to the compelling nature of it and the competitiveness.
A couple more good global questions. For global, is it appropriate to ask for a stipend for a translator in each country? You can use a translator in each country, but the cost of that translator would need to come from your grant. You do receive a research stipend for each of your trips, so that would be intended to cover translation services. And then if we submit a global scholar, were to go to three countries and one country rejects the application, does that sink the application entirely? Yes, it would. So choose your countries wisely and make sure that you're making a strong case for why you need to be in each country. Okay, what advice do you have for someone whose application was not successful in a prior round and is trying to figure out how to revise it to write a better proposal for resubmission? That's a good question. I guess it really depends on where your application, stopped. Did it stop before or after peer review? If your application made it through peer review and then made it to the host country and it wasn't selected, then my advice to you would be to make sure that you're addressing the question of why this country and, you know, really keep them more in mind as a stakeholder. It may just be that, you know, your application didn't make a strong enough case for why it would be important to their country to fund your project. And then also keeping the State Department more in mind as a stakeholder of talking about how your project would help accomplish the mission of the Fulbright program to promote mutual understanding. That's something that they're really looking for in all applications. If it didn't make it through peer review, then taking a look at the review criteria on our website and making sure that you're answering all of those questions is what I would recommend. Okay. I think we got to most of the questions. Are there any other ones you want to answer, Michelle?
So we had a question. This will be my last one that I'll take. Is UNICEF an eligible host center? There's a UNICEF center in Europe. Would that be eligible along with a research center in East Africa as a co-host? So in general, because of the whole mission of Fulbright, the idea is that, you know, you from the U.S., as a scholar from the U.S., going over to the host country, or countries in this case, that you would be collaborating with an institution that is uniquely let's say, German or Italian or French or Brazilian. Any of these large international umbrella agencies don't really kind of speak to the what we're hoping to have in this collaborative kind of approach. So better to have more of a local, kind of institution or research center that's unique to that country, that's specific to that country. And that would, I think, be much more appropriate for the Fulbright Scholar Program. And in fact, many countries would indicate that in their award description for the single country award, that you must affiliate with an institution that is uniquely of that country, not an international kind of global institution. So.
Great. I see there's, okay, there are just two more questions I'm going to answer, and then we're going to end the webinar for today. But one is the applicant considered as competitive if that person is not connected with the 2 or 4 year institution of higher education? That depends on the, check the award descriptions that might mention it there. But the type of institution that you're coming from, if you're coming from a community college or you're an independent scholar or you're a professional, you are considered equally eligible and competitive for the awards in our catalog. And then the last question, what are the most important things to communicate to the person writing the invitation in terms of writing of what Fulbright will expect from the host institution? So we encourage host institutions to provide office space when possible and to engage the scholar in the campus community whenever possible, but there isn't any obligation on their part to do cost sharing. The level of support depends on the institution. Some offer housing, some offer transportation. But to answer your question most directly, there's no obligation for the host institutions to provide office space, transportation, housing, but they can. And if that's something that you're interested in, I mean, definitely ask them about it. If you don't ask, it might not be offered. So that is, at minimum, what they're supposed to be doing is, welcoming you into their campus community and including you in things. And I said one more. I said those were the last two. One last one is age a factor? No. There's no age restrictions. We have lots and lots of, retired faculty that apply for Fulbrights as well. So we don't discriminate. All right. So I hope we got to get to most of your questions. If there are any others, you can follow up with us at the email addresses that are listed in the award description. We just want to thank you guys for staying with us. We went a little over time, but I hope it was helpful. We look forward to hearing from you guys, and good luck with your applications.
Right, and this webinar will be archived. We've recorded it today, and it will be archived within 5 business days. So if you go back on our website where the webinar schedule was, where you registered for this, you'll access that and also register for the upcoming virtual application walkthroughs and advising sessions next month. So all the best, good luck, and do the best you can by August 1st.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.